News that the current administration in the U.S. is displeased with the Federal Reserve. And other interesting topicality, the subject of today's show. It's a pleasure to welcome back Bob Hoy, the editor-in-chief investment strategist of chartsandmarkets.com, formerly Institutional Advisors.
Chris, good to be with you, and thanks for setting this up.
You're the first person on the speed dial here at the studio we decided to ring up. President has criticized the Fed. CNBC and other news outlets are saying that 4 days ahead of the Jackson Hole meeting, where our current Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, will give his big speech. I'd like your take, because so many of our listeners are not big fans of the Federal Reserve.
Right. Trump is not the first president to lean on the Fed. The other thing is to put the Federal Reserve system in perspective. It was innocently enough described, they figured that the Fed would be able to prevent the financial setbacks that precede recessions. Now, that was a way back in the 19-teens. And if you take the Fed from since it opened its doors in January 1914, there's been 18 recessions. So the theory that the Fed can prevent recessions hasn't been successful over 100 years of testing. So then what has happened, it's been corrupted into funding an experiment in unlimited government. And, of course, that involves easy credit and the generation of financial bubbles, all of which help to serve to fund the state. Just the mere practice of currency depreciation is, in a way, funding the state. So the whole of the Fed is evil. But anyways, with Trump criticizing the Fed and leaning on the Fed, hoping for lower interest rates, I think this is the public man talking. It's like it's the president rather than Trump, because if it was a previous president, be saying the same thing. And the issue here is, of course, is the establishment doesn't like rising interest rates. They seem to think it causes bad things. But if you take a look, 100 years of business history or so, and you look at the free market rates, you know, like market rates of interest, like the T-bill rate, the short end, interest rates go up in a boom. So as long as interest rates are going up, it confirms the boom is on. So that's a good thing. The danger is when the T-bill rate turns down. So I'm disappointed in Trump saying that, but as I said, it's probably the public man, his desk, the office, whatever, speaking, and it's talking orthodox stuff that they don't like rates going up. And the damage that the Federal Reserve has done in 100 years by artificially lowering interest rates is horrendous. It effectively, that was the pitch on what they were trying to do. But the end result was it depreciated the dollar down to about only 93% of its purchasing power of 1914. So the short data rate will go up until the boom is over. Then it goes down. And then following that by a couple of months, the Federal Reserve would make a big noise and cut Fed funds rate, or as it used to be called, the discount rate. We had, Chris, a lot of fun with this in 2007 when in the summer you had credit spreads widening and the yield curve steepening, stuff like that, which then the establishment became a little nervous. And then in order to comfort themselves, they said, oh, the Fed will cut rates. And gosh, I got a nice little piece on that. I can't remember who it is at the moment. I think it was September the 7th. 2007. So the Fed was going to do the perfectly timed interest rate cut and all would be well. Now, obviously, that guy was in theory land and had never looked at the history of interest rates. And the history is simple. Short rates go up in a boom, and they go down in a bust. So then if you take the senior central bank, now the bank, the Federal Reserve, and formerly the Bank of England in London, so you can get really good numbers back to the 1873 bubble. So in that crash, the Bank of England's discount rate, I think it went up by about 700 basis points. And then in 1929, the Federal Reserve discount rate went up, I think, 450 basis points. And then following 2007, the interest rate fell from 5 to, you know, 0. So same sort of thing. But in that period of time, the lesson that just looking at history tells you is that not just that interest rates go up in a boom and down in a bust, but the harder the bust, the faster interest rates fall. So, Chris, this is going to be fascinating over the next couple of months because they're getting upset about the rising short rates. But on the other hand, I just wrote down a couple of headlines whereby China, which had been lending money generously to emerging countries, taking a look, I guess, $30 billion they lent to Venezuela, and they haven't got a hope getting that back. So they're now going to become a little cautious on this. And this is the one thing that the Austrian School of Economics, which did a reasonably practical study on interest rates and credit and money, the one thing they point out is that at a boom, you don't have to have the bankers call the loans to get the contraction. All they have to do is get a little nervous and stop making them. So I've got two headlines in the last 2 days that I will use to show that they're beginning to stop making loans, and that's all you need. Yeah, I'm disappointed in Trump leaning on the Fed, but I think he's a more practical businessman, and his businessman side, I don't think, would go along with that. The other thing that was interesting this week is the announcement that the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is going to be selling some crude oil, which makes sense to me. And actually, we've been calling on for this one since May, when crude was 72, eventually went to, 76. But when it was 72, I thought, Trump will sell from that petroleum reserve because it makes so much sense. You know, U.S. has now huge and growing reserves of petroleum stuff, you know, from natural gas to heavy crude. So, why keep that? So it's a good thing to sell it. And also it'll help his bargaining with Putin and Russia. If he can, Russia's got to be really scared of falling energy prices, because really all it is one big huge service station, as some wit described a few years ago. There's a line of that about Russian oil is being delivered to the east coast of the United States because the people in New England states don't like pipelines, whereby you've got good reserves in the western provinces in Canada. And the Ontario and Quebec people won't allow a pipeline from the west to the east, and they would sooner continue to get their oil on the Atlantic provinces from Venezuela, from Russia, and stuff like that.
I'd like to return the focus just briefly to our president's intention. He made it clear that he's not happy at all with the strong dollar. Quite a rally in the past several months, and actually the highest at last check of 14-month high last week. Now, he's not happy with the strong dollar because, as you know, I'm sure his key economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, has made it clear that this hurts exports. Whatever you think about this individual, he wants America to succeed economically, and he wants to see stronger exports. Obviously, a strong dollar makes our goods, at least on a relative basis, more expensive. Now, the thing I think he's missing is the strong dollar makes U.S. equities more appealing, the dividends, because it pays out in a stronger currency. And I think this is one of the reasons why you've seen the Dow, in particular in the blue chips, which tend to pay a higher dividend yield, do so remarkably well, even against this runaway NASDAQ market we had in the last few months. Okay, but back on point. So he's saying that this gives China, let's call it an artificial advantage, and he also notes that the Europeans, he feels, were manipulating the euro to improve their exports to our disadvantage. Now, whether or not we want to get into all the minutiae there, I'll leave that up to you. But I wanted to say that it all comes together on Monday, where he said he's not thrilled at all with the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell for raising rates and the manipulation from our key trading partners. And I think that if you bring this all together, it shows for the first time that I can recall in many years, at least 10 years, we have a standing president who is not afraid to take on the most invincible and powerful institution in the world. And I would argue that's the Federal Reserve. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. He is, on not wanting to talk the dollar down, that again is his office speaking. If, as a businessman, he would know that economists messing around with purchasing power of currency is just theoretical nonsense. And but the market forces will dominate, and in a post-bubble contraction, all of them, going away back for 300 years, the feature has been that the senior currency, during the contraction, becomes chronically strong against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. I invented that line a long time ago. And when the U.S. dollar index sold off hard early in the year down to 88, oversold, then what we needed was a few months of building a base, which it did, and then we've found that important bottoms like 2008 and 2014, that was the pattern. Oversold, build a base, and then it completed when the DX rose above the 20-week exponential moving average, and that was on April 23rd. So the dollar index is, again, got overbought when the first rush to almost 96. And then it's building a base over the last few weeks for what we figure can get up to 101 or 102 on the chart. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what the last high was. I think it was 103. But at any rate, the dollar index is behaving the way we figured it would once it got the breakout. And we also have the history that in a post-bubble contraction, the senior currency becomes strong. And, Chris, I think the mechanism behind that is that during the financial boom, serious money ends up reaching for yield and buying a whole lot of junk, and that includes many junk companies outside the U.S. and far too many countries outside the U.S. And that's due and payable, most of it, in U.S. dollars into New York. So in effect, the great bubble of expanding debt, then once the contraction starts, just servicing that debt becomes an immense short position. So on the longer term, the dollar is likely to get uncomfortably high. So this is where, unfortunately for Trump and him trying to talk the dollar down, I believe that's his office speaking, not himself. And if it was himself thinking as a businessman, you don't want to have the Fed doing anything, just and neither cheapening or pushing the dollar up, but market forces will push the dollar up. And then the other thing is that the Fed shouldn't be cheapening or pushing interest rates up or down. That should be strictly in the market hands anyways, which it is. As I said, once the T-bill rate rolls over and heads down, the Fed will then have no alternative but to lower the Fed funds rate, which was the case in 1929. The T-bill rate went up until, I think it was May, and then June had turned down, and then with the contraction becoming so visible at the end of September of 1929, then I think it was October when the Fed lowered its discount rate, and then the T-bill rate effectively went down to zero in the early 1930s. So there's none of what's going on now is new. And our view, as I've said, is that we have accomplished, the markets have accomplished a fabulous bubble. And sure, you've had, that was with the highs in December, January, and the NASDAQ has gone on to new highs, the Russell has, small caps, but the crux of this is how the market behaves over the next 6 to 8 weeks. Credit spreads have begun to turn, and we had the first, what we call the first breakout, that was in June, and then now you've had the correction against that, but in the last week, the spreads have started widening again. So what we're looking for is the second breakout in widening, and in 2007, that occurred in late August, early September, and as you recall, the S&P had its peak in the middle of October of 2007. So I would say, Chris, that what we look at in well, we called them our friends of the bull market back in February, and that hit. We said that the industrial commodities would recover until around May, which they did. And base metals had a good rally. Lumber went hysterical on the upside. And then after May, these would head down and would no longer be friends of the bull market. And yeah, the lumber got killed. Base metals had a pretty good hit. But these things are having a little rally now because they got oversold last week that we're getting a rally. So then the other two items are the credit spreads and the yield curve. And they were expected to be friendly until about May. Well, on the yield curve, which everybody's talking about, that it's flattening and you know, may become inverted, on the curve from the fives to the 30s, that is no longer on trend, but it hasn't reversed trend, so it's no longer friendly. So, Chris, our friends of the bull market are no longer friendly in aggregate. So we just watch how this plays out over the next 6 to 8 weeks.
You know, I think I have a competing view, though. It makes me cringe when I hear people talk about the end of this bull market. I have had some of the sharpest minds, well-known folks in the world on this show. I'm humbled to have them here, obviously, and this little dog and pony act. But nevertheless, what I've heard over the years is the only folks who have been consistently right have sort of looked away from the fundamentals and just said, you know, we are extremely overvalued, especially the S&P 500, obviously. Valuations are extended and then extended again, maybe three standard deviations from the norm. It's like old turkey from Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, Edwin Lefebvre. You know, after all, it is a bull market. This is one of those tides that can keep going and going. It reminds me of a gold bull market that started arguably around the year 2000-2001, lasted 12 consistent years, never a down year. Charlie Lee is a very successful fund manager, and he brought up a fresh perspective. It's a demographic that's stunning, and I think very few of our listeners will know this, and that is that millennials comprise 96 million Americans. So essentially, one in three people today was born around or after the year 2000. Now, this is a very unique group of people, just as were the X generation, which I fall into. They saw their parents lose their homes in 2008-2009. They have no trust whatsoever for the traditional financial banking system or traditional financial institutions, and they only are interested in things that are outside that system, such as the cryptocurrencies and our homes that are mostly paid for or financed without the traditional methods. These folks are expected now to continue investing not in the traditional stocks and bonds and real estate and whatnot. They are the highest purchasers of recreational vehicles. They're actually living in recreational vehicles since the 1950s and 60s. This is a new trend. Charlie Lee suggests that they will continue to invest, and they've only just started, primarily in decentralized and transparent markets, of course, the cryptocurrencies. He's predicting Bitcoin at a level that's so high, so far beyond anything anyone has ever announced, even in the peak of 2017, predicting something much further beyond 250,000, which is what we're calling for here by 2022. He claims that it will be primarily in the United States driven by the millennials, and then outside the United States, it will be driven by the need for financial services in third world and emerging economies where they simply just don't have access, and they haven't had access to these key services and financing and banking. And might that be the peak in U.S. equities and housing and lead to a resurgence in the cryptocurrency market?
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I appreciate Lee's work on the demographics, but we should look back to the 2000 bubble. That was part of that story was the demographics, is that the baby boomers were retiring, and every minute there was 10,000 baby boomers retiring, and they're all going to have a pension fund full of equities. Now, on that bubble, of which, as you know, I've done a lot of work, our beginning in January 2000, we had our bubble indicators, a whole bunch of stuff, and with the credit spreads and the yield curve, we counted out that probably the credit markets would begin to change in March of 2000. And what happened was is that as we got into March, the spreads and the curve and the bubble all blew out at the same time. But later on in 2000, you had the really serious change in the credit markets that then pushed off the bear market. So on the 2000 bubble, we had in January, we had a target for a possible high in March. On the 2007 bubble, our work on the credit markets, spreads in the curve, that year expected it to be positive into May or June, and that's when the reversals came in, and you recall that Bear Stearns began to announce their problems about in early June of 2007, and then the rest was, as I said a little while ago, the second breakout in widening credit spreads in late August that did the whole market in. And then now recently on the bubble in the Bitcoin, you recall that our October 4th edition said that everything was going to get bubbled, and even threw in that even the Dow Jones would get bubbled. And then the next part of that October 4th study was that there'd been so many spectacular speculations in the past that had concluded in the December-January window, the Nikkei bubble, last trading day of 89, and then gold and silver, I think it was January 20th of 1980, and we even found a peak in the Dow Jones, turn of the year one in 1893. So our target on that bubble was that it would likely conclude in December, January, and it did. So the work that we've done, Chris, has been, we try to get things, the big ones, some months before they happen, and then look for the technical excesses as they happen. Now, for example, on the Bitcoin stock itself, on December 19th, my colleague Ross and his technical staff got a sequential sell on the 19th, and there hadn't been that signal in 2 years, so we concluded that the correction would be the greatest in 2 years, and it was. So now the rest of it is in, as I said, in the hands of the credit market, and they have been friendly until recent, and they're not unfriendly. It's just they're no longer friendly. There's in the spread and in curves, there is not the distinctive trend change yet. But the way I'm looking at it now and writing for this week's piece is that we will be monitoring for the change. And this method of having the history plus the a very good technical analysis has served us well before. But on the demographics thing about the millennials, I should mention that when the demographic story was really broadcast, which was in 2000 bubble, and then after it went bad, Prechter at the Elliott Wave guys, he did do a thorough study of 1929 and that contraction, and he pointed out with a lot of evidence and charts and stuff, is that a market bust like that one pushes and changes the demographics. People stopped having babies, for example, stuff like that. So it's one of those things, Chris, that when you go and start working on demographics, it's best to consider that if you are in a fabulous bubble, the break in the bubble may change the demographics. So I'd be wary of demographic studies.
You obviously can't base your bullish analysis just on any single indicator, whether it be fundamental or technical, but a couple of interesting anecdotes. Firstly, anyone who's talking about cryptos, even the top guys like, you know, Novogratz, Lee, and so many others, always start off with, look, I believe cryptos could just as easily go to zip as they could to infinity, that we're in a big bubble here. However, there are some key things I'd like for people to keep in mind. The institutions have only just started to get invested in the cryptocurrencies. Currently, we estimate only 2-3% of Americans have any exposure at all to Bitcoin, and that might just be fractional. And if you look at the adoption curve on Bitcoin, we are truly at the genesis. I mean, this is just the nascent market that we see. So there has been very little adoption in the United States or outside the United States. Another key point that I'd add in here, and in any new market, similar to email or AOL or something like that, it's very easy to assume that because you've seen a really big blow-off peak and a 20-fold move from the beginning of 2017 to the end, we saw a 20x. That is very rare in almost any market. However, we've seen similar moves in Bitcoin before, and it held its ground and then continued to move higher. What I think is happening here, for the first time in history, we have a market that skipped Wall Street altogether. It really was a grassroots Main Street revolution. Again, for the first time, let's say since the Dutch tulip mania in Amsterdam, or earlier if you like, it is the hoi polloi, the masses in total control of this revolution, and now Wall Street, crony capitalistic system, they are scrambling. You know, we find out that Goldman, JP Morgan, and many others are just now setting up trading desks in the cryptocurrency market. Many of the hedge funds and institutions are as well. So as we see this revolution unfold and people start to adopt, this is a much more transparent and it's a much more private way. The real key takeaway here is we could see a resurgence, I think. If we can hold 5,700 on Bitcoin, which may not hold, we may still have to retest, it could give us a springboard that sets this market back up. We're seeing a washout now, similar, I think, to the precious metals. Into 2022, we see favorable things ahead. And so if you want to forget all the fundamental and the technical analysis, I invite listeners to argue with me. Keep sending the emails. You're challenging all of us here to think outside the box, and we appreciate that. Call into our hotline and leave your Q&A. The cryptocurrency market has unique aspects to it that have never really emerged, but there's one that stands out as a must-hear attribute. The cryptos are the most inversely correlated, or non-correlated asset class today. In fact, they're becoming even more inversely correlated week by week, month by month. This is one of the first times in decades, maybe even longer, that any such thing has emerged. Add to that fact that it's only, a $300 billion market? That's not even peanuts for large institutions to dip their toe in the water. There is nothing that makes deep-pocketed money managers and financial institutions and pension fund managers salivate more than an asset class that deeply lowers the beta of stocks and bonds and the traditional real estate. An off-the-chart alpha. If you just take 1% of your fund or your pension funds and you invest it in cryptos, you're going to get a 10 or 20% offset in your overall portfolio beta. So you double or treble the expected return on the upside of your portfolio. That point alone means that every one of our listeners should have some exposure to cryptos. Your thoughts?
Your arguments are sound. You've put a lot of evidence together to build a case. But what you're talking about is the cryptocurrency that is a finite item, and you're playing the shortage and the potential for that there's too many buyers and not enough product. My view on the crypto and this side is that it has the ability to provide a currency that is relatively constant purchasing power. And for that currency, it also has to be very liquid. So the Bitcoin at the moment, you are playing the fact that it is not liquid. The utility to society will be at some time to where a variation will provide a very liquid currency for transactions and whatnot. It may end up being related to gold. I don't know, but with this popular uprising going on where people are attempting to get direct control of their government again, as in government by the people, I believe it'll be successful. But the other part of that is in order to protect themselves from the bandits in government, it will have to have a currency that the intellectuals, the economists, the politicians and the bureaucrats can't mess up to their advantage. So this is where somewhere, Chris, there will be a crypto item that is highly liquid and will provide a currency of relatively constant purchasing power, and I'm really looking forward to it.
We've all heard the emperor has no clothes, we remember. It's as though there were a Bengal or Siberian tiger, and the emperor just did not believe that a tiger could exist. Our central bankers are the emperors. They are convinced, oh, this cryptocurrency nonsense, it's just electronic digital money. These people are deluded with themselves. It's a bunch of kids in their mama's basement driving Lambos in their sandals and Crocs. There really is a Bengal tiger loose in the currency market. There are Turing complete currencies out there that aren't just currencies. For instance, Ethereum. It's not just a currency. As I said, it's Turing complete, which is just fancy lingo or jargon to indicate that it is a highly programmable money. It's a contract of exceptional power that people are only now beginning. Even the sharpest minds are beginning to recognize there's $100 billion, maybe more, market in crypto assets, which started with crypto kitties. Now I'm on to crypto pets. and we're distributing those to our listeners here today, which we think it's going to be much bigger than CryptoKitties. We're giving them away for new subscribers. When you bring this together, you can print them up out of thin air. There's tens of thousands of them. Why don't you think that's diluting the market? And I point out, well, it may dilute it to some extent, but each currency has its own unique qualities. It's like trying to compare Google with Amazon, Amazon with Yahoo, Yahoo with Netflix. You know, it's a non sequitur. It does not follow. So I would just like to leave that with listeners that while I agree with you, Bob Hoy, that as a currency, this is the genesis of a currency, and it's really a weak currency. But if you look at the entire, let's call it domain or crypto space, as they call it, I want to say $20 to $60 trillion market that is only right now around $300 billion. If you're trying to get rich quick, it's way too volatile of a market. But if you're a smart, long-term investor and you want to take 1 to 3%, maybe 5% at the most, and you want to rotate out of some equities profits or bond profits into something that's going to massively lower your overall beta while supercharging the alpha on the upside, just think of it from a scientific perspective. Throw some darts to the top guys. As it continues to drop, you can get it at fire sale prices. Parting thoughts on the precious metals. Do you think if the U.S. dollar tops here that it might give us a buying opportunity?
Last week, on the gold and the gold stocks like GDXG, we got a downside on them, a sequential buy. We also got that on the base metals like copper. So we can get a rally for a few weeks. And also, a week and a half ago on crude oil, we noted that the trading pattern was now into vulnerable, and it sort of got hit a bit. So base metals and the precious metals can rally for a few weeks, but we keep in mind that copper can have a seasonal low in October, crude oil seasonal low in December, January, and lumber, which was a fabulous bubble in that one, a low in October as well. So once we're past middle of September, industrial commodities can head south. And it won't be good for the stock market. So there we are.
You do feel that every portfolio should at least be thinking about rotating into some discounted precious metals if you've had some stellar gains.
That would be for a trade, a brief trade from a week and a half ago until into September. Then after that, watch out.
You're not a believer, then, that the Fed may stop raising rates next year as the EU and China pull back their QE operations, which could really nosedive the greenback?
Yeah, the Fed is going to get beat up by market forces yet again. We're in a bubble. It looks like the Fed is in control. And then in the contraction, the power shifts. I'm easy to get in touch with. Just Google bobhoy.com. You know, the www.bobhoye.com. That gets us into the whole system.
And chartsandmarkets.com.
Yep.
Have the best day, Bob.
Okay, thanks. Bye, Chris.